Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Paul, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is 10-1-83, and my home group is the Answer Group in Hayward, California. I'd like to ask for a moment of silence and gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 75 years. And join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contribution. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And I'm going to read the anonymity statement. There may be some here who are not familiar with our tradition of personal anonymity at the public level. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. Thus, we respectfully ask that AA speakers and AA members not be photographed, videotaped, or identified by full name on audio tapes and in published or broadcast reports of our meetings, including those reports on the Internet. The assurance of anonymity is essential in our efforts to help other problem drinkers who may wish to share their recovery program with us. And our tradition of anonymity reminds us that AA principles come before personalities. Out of respect for others, please do not take photographs during any of the meetings at the International Convention. Also, be considerate when taking photographs around convention venues. Take care that you do not capture images of AA members, family members, or friends who did not give permission and who may not wish to appear in your pictures. Please do not post recognizable photographs of identifiable AA members on websites accessible to the public, including unrestricted pages on social networking sites. The recordings of the meetings are available for purchase at the recording sales booth in Hall B of the Convention Center. And it's my honor to introduce our first speaker, Mark from Austin.
My name is Mark. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is Western Trails in South Austin, Texas. Yes, put it up for Western Trails. Don and I go to the 8:30 meeting, 8:30 in the morning, every day of the week that meeting is held. If you ever get to South Austin, and it's not very far, folks, it's 70 miles away. If you ever get to Western Trails, come on in. We've got free donuts, really bad coffee, and great fellowship. We'd love to have you there. So I was just thinking that I think it's a great idea to put up the warning about not posting pictures on publicly accessible sites, but have y'all seen some of the pictures that people put up of themselves drunk on Facebook? You know, and we're really concerned that nobody sees that we're sober on Facebook. I think it's a good thing. It just astounds me. My sobriety date is September 18th, 1993, and I'll tell you right now, I can get maybe 2 weeks of sobriety if I try really hard by going to AA meetings but not working the steps and not having a sponsor. And that's based on experience. That is about the most that I can accumulate. The only way I've been able to stay sober since September 18th, 1993 is by working the steps and doing it just about every day. There have been a few days where I've slacked. I won't lie. But the only way that I've been able to stay sober one day at a time is by having that transformation of my thought, my attitudes, my actions. And that's what the steps have done for me. I think today's meeting is actually supposed to be about relationships and sobriety. So I'm going to warn you right now, if you came here expecting to have like some aha moment of wisdom, you're going to have to wait for the second speaker. Because I really don't know that much about relationships in sobriety. But hopefully by the end of what I'm saying, it'll be clear what I do know. I grew up in Iowa. I was socially awkward. And my sophomore year in high school, I had been drinking for probably about a year, year and a half. And one of my friends had signed up to watch somebody's house while they were on vacation. And, of course, it means that seven of us in high school show up at that house to watch the house. There's four girls and four guys and three girls, and we start raiding the liquor cabinet. And, you know, at probably about the third or the fourth drink, I realized 15-year-old Mark is about to have the time of his life. You know, this guy who's never been on a date before or held hands with a girl or kissed a girl, tonight's the night that little Mark is going to become a man, right? You know, I'm looking around, these cute girls are having a great time. I should warn, too, I've got a friend named Shoeless Melissa at Western Trails. And Shoeless Melissa will remind me, Mark, if you ever hope to get laid, you should not refer to yourself as Little Marky. But, but so we're getting drunk, and at some point in that night, I kind of come up out of this haze, and I look around, and there's nobody in the living room. You know, it's a three-bedroom house. There's six other people. All these other kids, you know, have, like, split off into couples, and I'm still stuck there with this, like, empty glass. And I get really, really sad, and I'm thinking to myself, what is the matter? I mean, what don't they see in me? And so I go over to the liquor cabinet, and there's nothing left except Everclear. Yeah, 190 proof or something, grain alcohol. And I don't know how much I drank that night, but I do know that when I got dropped off at my parents' house, I could not stand, and I had beginning stages of alcohol poisoning. And so that was at 15 years old. My parents took me to a hospital. I convinced my mom, a psychiatric nurse, that it was a desperate plea for help. And so she put me in the psychiatric ward, which wound up being a mistake. But I convinced my parents to pull me out of the psychiatric ward about a week later. My mental health was no better than it had been before I had gone in, but I had learned a really good ping pong serve. I don't know how many of you have spent time in institutions like detox and psych wards, but they always seem to have ping pong tables. I never learned how to return, but I spent enough time that I learned how to serve. So they've got a ping pong table somewhere around San Antonio. Maybe you guys can teach me how to return. That is what I knew about relationships. You know, I mean, I would start to date somebody for the next, you know, 5-8 years, and I never knew how to be in a relationship with somebody. I got sober at 25 in 1993, and when I got sober, part of it was because of a girl. There was a girl who was much younger than I was, who had been sober for a couple years, and apart from the fact that she was cute, when I looked in her eyes, she had that indefinable something that told me she knew what her life was about, and I was so desperate for that. And everything in my life was falling apart. And I won't go into the details of that, but I will say that within like about a week or two of getting sober, I went out with a bunch of my friends who had not stopped drinking. We were at a bar called the Black Cat in Austin, Texas, on 6th Street. It was a great place where lots of bikers would go. They'd have, you know, whatever kind of quasi-metal music was playing in the 1990s. And I'm hanging out with all my friends, and I'm thinking to myself, this isn't fair. All my buddies can still drink like gentlemen, shoot drugs like gentlemen, smoke weed every day like gentlemen. And I'm stuck here, you know, trying to be sober and be prim and proper at the Black Cat, which it didn't quite make sense to me that maybe if I want to be sober, I shouldn't necessarily be hanging out at a couple weeks of sobriety at the Black Cat. But I didn't drink that night. I wound up going home, and as I'm going home, I'm going past Kirby Lane Cafe in South Austin, which was the restaurant that was my place of employment. It's where I met all my friends. And I'm driving past Kirby Lane Cafe, and I see this girl. And I come back to Kirby, and I tell her, you know, I'm really glad that I saw you because I'm having a bad night. And I start to whine about whatever it is that's going on. And she's nodding her head going, yeah, that's too bad. And I say, why don't you come back to my house and read the big book with me? Isn't that sweet? And the hard part is that she actually did. She came back to my house and she brought out my big book. And she taught me something that I have kept with me for the rest of my days. I don't know how much you guys can see this. This is fourth edition, which is falling apart. This wasn't the big book that I had at the time, but it is very heavily underlined. She taught me how to take out a highlighter and a pen and highlight everything in the big book that says something to me. Right in the margins. Study this thing like a textbook, because if I want a gift sober, if I want this, I've got to learn it. I can't just make it up on my own. And for me, the big book really tells me how it is that I can make all this work. I haven't had a lot of relationships in sobriety in those years. I dated one woman for about 6 months, and she taught me how to do a fourth step inventory, indirectly. And after getting through that relationship, I did a fifth step with my sponsor. You guys are going to think that I'm so full of it. I got done with the fifth step, and you know how the big book, it says go home for an hour, take the book down, review it, figure out, you know, have you done all of the work so far, and then do step 6 and 7. I didn't actually do that. I shouldn't have mentioned the bar that I was at earlier in the year, but I went to the Black Cat, okay? I was at the Black Cat again after doing a fifth step. And I should say that when I did my fifth step, one of the things that came true to me that was really clear is that I kept repeating the same thing in my relationships. I kept walking into a relationship expecting someone to do what I wanted them to do without ever communicating what it was, and then copping an enormous resentment when they failed to read my mind. And so I'm at the Black Cat because there's this incredibly hot rock and roll singer, and she's on stage, and I know that this is going to be, you know, the one. My rock and roll goddess is going to, like, make all my dreams come true. She comes down after the show, and she's talking to me, and we are friends, you know, but she's not going on with me. She's got her mind on, like, what's going on with her career, and she's in the middle of something that I'm saying, which has to be, like, really portentous and important and so wise. She runs off, you know, and goes off to talk to somebody from the music industry. And so I'm sitting there again, Black Cat, looking around, beer, wine. What am I doing here? So I go home, and I remind myself of what I'm doing here. And I do step 6 and 7. And the thing that showed me is that even knowing, and that is just one of the things that had come out of my fifth step, even knowing what my character defects are, it doesn't help me change them. I cannot change my character defects myself. Only God, and only if it serves His will, is going to remove those character defects from me. But doing steps 4 and 5 showed me what my sex ideal was. I don't think I ever had used those words before, sex ideal. You know, I mean, I had, like, ideal sex, but not a sex ideal. And so after I did that, I was in an emotional place, and I think a spiritual place, that I was able to meet a woman that I've been with since about that time. So since about September 1994. She and I moved off to Puerto Rico together for a while, and I had a sponsor in Puerto Rico, a guy named Artie. And Artie told me that I really had to have kids. He was 65 years old and never had kids, and he said, Mark, you're going to have kids. And I would tell him, Artie, you don't know the first thing about me. You know, that's not where my head is. But after I came back to Austin, in a sequence of events that I won't go into, but I consider it to be miraculous, my girlfriend at the time, Jill, found out that she was pregnant. And it was the scariest thing. I should warn you, too, sometimes I cry, like, at the drop of a hat. So if I start weeping, you know, it's nothing compared to McDonald's commercials during the Olympics. I can't keep enough Kleenexes out. But Finding out that Jill was pregnant was the scariest thing that had ever happened to me. I was more scared of that than going up and facing the judge for drunk driving charges, you know? But I called my family, I called my sponsor, and what my sponsor said was, "Mark, have you written those fears down?" "No, I haven't." She goes, "Why don't you come over, bring a pen and paper, and tell Jill to come over about an hour later." And so I said, "Sure, no problem." And so I went over to my sponsor Rosie's house, and I'm writing everything down that I'm scared of. And I'm discovering a lot about what I felt still about my dad that had never come up. You know, how can I be a dad if I'm still so mad at my father? But I wrote all this down. I shared it with Rosie. Jill comes over, and the three of us pray together. And that had never been done before. Jill happens not to be an alcoholic and not in a 12-step program. And we live really different lives in that regard. You know, she and I had never sat down and kneeled down and prayed together before. And Rosie asks both of us, "What do you think God wants you to do?" And not only did I know what God wants me to do, I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a father. So my daughter, Soren Rose, was born 12 years ago on May 5th. She was named partly after my sponsor, Rosie, and the woman who's now Soren's godmother, and partly after Soren Kierkegaard. I happen to be an effete snob, and so I like naming children after Danish philosophers. But Soren Kierkegaard also has got these incredible prayers. And if you get a chance sometime, go look him up and read some of the prayers that he's written. And it meant a lot to me when Jill was pregnant with Soren. Rosie also, after we did that inventory and sharing that inventory in prayer, Rosie said, "Okay, you now know what you want to do. Let's start moving into how we're going to make it happen." And Rosie was there and organized the wedding for us, organized everything. We were married within a week. Boom. And it happened. And it was beautiful. One thing that I should say, this relationship that I'm talking about, it seems perhaps like, okay, I'm saying that God's will manifests itself because Jill and I have been together this entire time. That's not the case. I believe that God's will manifested itself because I did the 12 steps when I was faced with a challenge. And it doesn't matter to me what the challenge is. Anything. Relationships, employment, finances. Every time that I'm faced with something that seems insurmountable, that seems like it's too big for me, if I work the steps, the solution is always the same. Trust God. Turn it over to Him. And find somebody else that you can turn your thoughts to. I need to say something about Rosie before I go any further, because I think there are a lot of people who are express concern about a male having a female sponsor. I express concern about that. If any males in the room are thinking about having a female sponsor, I highly suggest you don't do it. It's really difficult talking about about sex stuff with Rosie. But I also don't have a choice. I had gone from the time that I moved back to Austin for about a year, I didn't have a sponsor. And my friend Charlie finally called me on it and said, "Mark, how long are you going to be sponsoring yourself? Because your sponsor kind of sucks." He also suggested, "Mark, why don't you pray about finding a sponsor and let God find you a sponsor?" Because what I was doing was nobody could compare to Artie, and so therefore I wasn't getting a sponsor. So I prayed before I walked into the meeting that Charlie and I were at, and I said, "God, show me the sponsor that I'm supposed to have." And I walked into the meeting, and Rosie happened to be talking, and she talked about sponsorship. And I thought that was a miracle. She told me, you know, a week later, "Mark, the meeting was about sponsorship. Everybody was talking about sponsorship. You just heard me." But Rosie said something that really, really touched my heart. And so I went up to her afterwards and I said, "Will you be my sponsor?" And she said yes. She jokes that she said yes because she thought I was gay. And after she heard my first inventory, she realized the mistake that she had made. But by then she was committed, you know. I have many times wanted to fire Rosie as a sponsor because it's too hard to work with her. But I don't have that choice, you know. if you ask God for something and he gives it to you, how do you say, okay, what about a second try? I don't know how to do it. The last thing that I want to say is that my wife Jill and I have been married for almost 13 years. We'll have been married 13 years in September. If our divorce doesn't go through by then, she decided in the last 6 months that she is no longer in love with me and that she wants her own life. And man, that is a great opportunity to once again break out the 12 steps and figure out resentment and fear. And I know that I'm going to be okay. I know that Joel will be okay. I know that our daughter Soren will be okay. I can't see exactly how, but I know it is true because I've seen so many people in these rooms go through exactly the same thing. I wish I knew more about relationships than I do, but I'm really grateful to have been here. Thank you.
Thank goodness I don't have to follow that. Thank you. And our next speaker is John from Pueblo.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Paul. My name is John, and I am an alcoholic. Good to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome to anyone that's new. I hope you hear something that makes you want to keep coming back today. I'm looking around at a room of miracles. You know, I always wanted to see like a burning bush, you know, or something. And the fact is every time I come to one of these conventions where I go into a small town in Nebraska or some other place, and there's eight people sitting around a basketball court, and they're sharing a pot of coffee and a big book, I'm seeing a room full of burning bushes. I'm seeing miracles that are happening right in front of me. My home group is Mount Carmel, Mile High Group. It's the noon meeting. It's in Pueblo, Colorado. We call it Pueblo, Colorado, for those of you who are coming to visit someday. And I think it's the greatest home group in the world. And if you don't think your home group is the greatest group in the world, then you need to find a new home group. That's my thought. I'm here to share my experience, strength, and hope. And, you know, when they first said, you know, when they gave me the topic and they said, relationships and recovery, expletives started to come out. And I decided that wasn't really spiritual. And I decided that I'd think about that for a couple of minutes. And then I remembered what my first sponsor told me about relationships and recovery. And I asked him, I said, I was probably like 3 months sober. And I said, Greg, is it true that, you know, I'm going to have to wait a year before I can have relationships and recovery? And he said, well, ask me in 10 years. I said, what? You mean I can't have a relationship for 10 years? He said, no, that's when I'm going to know something about relationships and recovery. Greg was a wise man. He taught me a lot. And I thank God for that man. And I thank God for all of you. My sobriety date is November 1st, 2001. For those of you who are binary, that's 110101, which is a reminder to me that I might only have one shot at this thing. I got sober in Denver, Colorado. The first meeting I attended of Alcoholics Anonymous was in Nellingen, Germany in 1983. I had been instructed by the chaplain to go to that meeting. Because I might find something I wanted there. I realized it was next to the NCO club, and that was fine. It was a good jumping-off place, because I stayed for 5 minutes and went right into the bar because you guys scared the crap out of me. Early on, I had this sense that there's something wrong with my drinking and the way I had relationships. I remember I was in this relationship with this absolutely beautiful woman, and I was probably around 21, 22, and she worked in a bar, and matter of fact, she was the bartender and owned the bar, which was like ideal, an ideal relationship. And, you know, she said to me one time, she said, I don't think it's normal that a person walks in and has 8 gin and tonics in 10 minutes. You know, you might have a problem. And I thought, you're right. I do have a problem. I got to get rid of this witch. That's what I've got. This has got to end now. And the thing was, is that that became true with every single relationship that I had from then on. And I don't just mean my boy-girl relationships. Every relationship. My relationship with my family. My relationship with my jobs. My relationship, you know, with men and women. My relationship with God. Alcohol dissolved every single one of those relationships. It eroded the very fabric of that. It did it slowly and insidiously over a period of time. I didn't even realize it was happening, but it became all powerful. I had to get rid of anything that was getting between me and alcohol. And I was effective at it. I was really effective at it. They taught me early on to talk about, you know, what happened, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And what it was like, well, my relationship with my family. My sister's sitting here today. I, too, cry at the drop of a hat. And I think that, you know, I think that's just the ice melting around my heart, you know, that had stayed there for so many years. And when the sunlight of the Spirit hits it for a period of time, it begins to melt. It's a glacial process, you know. And I think if you understand that, you know you understand me a little bit. The thing is that, you know, my relationship with my family, you know, we grew up in Pueblo, Colorado. We moved to San Francisco, California, or to the Bay Area, just north of there in Marin County. And I lived there for most of my life, until I was probably in my 30s. Traveled a little bit in Europe, bounced around a little bit in the Army, did a couple of different things. But the fact is that most of the time I was in the Bay Area. I ended up, you know, like many, you know, people, I wanted to be artistic, so I became a chef. I wanted to be artistic, so I became a carpenter. I wanted to be artistic, so I became a ditch digger. You know, I tried to be artistic, you know. I was a tortured soul, and so I drank, you know. That was part of the whole angst that went along with that, and, you know, and it fit me well. The thing is that at one point or another, I don't know how it happened, other than, you know, alcoholism. I became homeless, and I was living on the streets, and I lived at Petaluma Boulevard and that Bushy Bush over there on the left side. You know, that's where I lived. And I attended my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank you for having coffee and donuts. You're the reason I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because what had happened was is that I drank myself into a state of reasonableness. In other words, I passed out on some train tracks trying to kill myself. That was the way I was going to get this thing fixed. So I laid down on these train tracks, and I was hoping that the next freight train that came along would end it all. And it would look like an accident. See, then I wouldn't be responsible. I was good at that. And the thing was is that that theme also carried through all my relationships, is I wasn't responsible. I wasn't part of that problem. I didn't take any responsibility for it. So I'm laying on these train tracks, and this other homeless person walks along in the middle of the night and trips over me and goes, "What the hell are you doing down there?" And I couldn't say, "Oh, I'm trying to off myself." You know, I said, "I just fell asleep. I passed out." "Well, get up," you know, and she said, "Why don't you, you know, tomorrow morning at 6:30, there's a meeting across, there's these people across the street over there, and they give away free coffee and donuts." And I thought, that sounds like a good idea. My social calendar was, you know, wasn't really full at that point. you know, and so what did I do? You know, I walked over to this little shopping mall, and I walked in, and there were these people in there, and they were smiling and laughing at 6:30 in the morning in Petaluma, California. And sure enough, they had free coffee and stale donuts. And I've been back to that meeting in sobriety since, and those coffee and donuts are still there. And I'm pretty sure they're the same ones. That's okay, though. It got me in, and it got my butt in a seat, and I began to hear something. And there was a big sign behind the chairperson, and it said, "Alcoholism is the disease of loneliness." Wow. I thought that was a load of crap, you know? I'm not lonely. I had my best friend right here in my hip pocket. I didn't need any of you people. I had it. But when I read these rules that you had on the wall, you know, these things, the steps and the traditions, whatever those are, I looked at those things and it said, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. And I thought, that's possible. That's possible. I don't seem to be able to stop drinking. And then the next line really whacked me. It said that our lives had become unmanageable. I thought, that's not true. My life is pretty manageable. I'm living in a bush with rats for roommates. I'm drinking $2 for $1 bottles of Coca-Cola flavored wine. You know, and my life hasn't become unmanageable. The delusion was so strong it was leading me right into death. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous speaks to me loud and clear on every single page. And the thing is that, you know, as I journeyed through this thing, I began to realize that I saw things as I was drinking that eventually would teach me how to live life. There was a homeless guy in the shelter that I would go to when it was really getting bad, and he used to take 3 steps forward and turn all the way to the right and say some incantation, and then he would take 3 steps and turn all the way to the left and he'd say something else. And one day, once I had enough Listerine and $2 for $1 bottles of Coca-Cola flavored wine on board, I asked him what the hell he was doing. And he looked at me like I was crazy, and he said, I'm keeping the world from spinning off its axis. I thought, you are nuts. And I took another swig. But once I got sober a few years later, I realized something. Every time this guy did that, it worked. His world never spun off its axis. And every time I picked up a drink, mine did. So who was crazier, him or me? The fact is that I didn't realize that my world had spun off its axis. Every relationship that I had was poisoned by alcohol. Every single one. When I talk about my family, towards the end of my drinking, I do one of those wonderful things where you just disappear off the face of the earth and you join a carnival or something, you know, one of those, you know, something you decide to suddenly, you know, build nuclear reactors in your basement or something. You know what I'm saying? That you had a great idea. Any of you who are new to this program, you know you're in trouble if you're new when the first words of your mouth, out of your mouth are, I have this idea. My sponsor told me that was not for me. That's for the advanced class. You do not get that one. So anyway, the thing is that there I am, and I know that I've got, you know, I'm in trouble. But what I didn't know what was happening at the time was that my sister had received a call from my 80-year-old mother, who asked her to look into whether or not this person she saw on the news, this homeless person who had died, who was a John Doe, might be her brother. My sister was a hospice nurse at the time. She knew all the coroners in the Denver metro area, so she began calling. And every time a John Doe would show up, dead of alcohol-related causes, she would have to call that coroner and know that on the other end of the line, there was very good possibility he would say, yes, this looks like this might be your brother. Please come in and identify the body. And the thing was, is that this is how it was happening to them. And every time she would have to do that, she told me last night, she said, I was so pissed at you that if you did show up, I was going to kill you myself. But she also realized that that was somebody else's brother, father, son, who was laying on a slab in a cold mortuary with no identification who died of alcoholism. And that's what we do. That's how we die. We die alone. We die lonely. I see that almost every single day in my job. And I'll tell you about that in just a moment. The thing is that that's what my relationship had become with my family. Relationships with employers. When I had one, they liked me when I was relatively sober. But those quickly dissolved. I no longer was employable. I didn't have relationships with women because, well, I just didn't. That's just the way it was. Partially because they saw me coming, you know. Because I really didn't have relationships. I had hostages. That's really what I had. That's how it worked. They were hostages to my selfishness and self-centeredness. It was a horror show of all the best kind. And the big book talks about sweet relationships are dead. And you know who killed them? It was me. And I had to face that when I did my inventory as well. I had to look that up. I had to make sure I understood how that really looked. So I go in, my sister, you know, says, you know, are you ready to try something different? After she finally found me. And I said yes. I don't know what kind of insanity took me over, but I was willing to try anything at that point. So I went into the Salvation Army. Well, first of all, she took me up to Estes Park. She had worked as an emergency room nurse for years. She'd seen lots of men detox, some of whom die during the process. As a medical person, I can tell you that a heroin addict only thinks he's going to die, but an alcoholic probably can very likely do that during their detox. So the thing is that she takes me up there, and you know, I'm waiting for those monsters to come because my detoxes were cockroaches crawling out of my skin and all the horrible stuff. I remember once I was in a hotel room and I tried to detox myself, and I imagined all those cockroaches crawling all over me and that horrible, you know, thing. And I woke up 3 days later, and when I flipped the lights on, all these damn cockroaches went whoosh off into the corner, and I went, shit, that really happened. Pardon my language. Yeah, so I detoxed under bushes from then on. The thing is that she sat there with me through that entire process, and it didn't happen. One of the first miracles. The sky turned red, and the aurora borealis shone for the first time in Estes Park that night. The sky was red and purple. I remember looking at the sky, telling my sister, I said, are you seeing what I'm seeing, or am I having a hemorrhage? She said, I'm seeing what you're seeing. I went in the Salvation Army, and I went through that program there in Denver, Colorado. And these guys would stand up on Wednesday in chapel, and they would say something right along the lines of, they would say, my name is Joe, and I'm here to get my life back. And I would think, what part of my life do I want back? I realized I needed a new life, absolutely brand new, new relationships with my family, new relationships with God, new relationship with every person in my life. I had to rebuild from the ground up. And that's what I began to do. And I did that with a sponsor by the name of Greg C. And Greg C. walked me through those steps. You know, and he worked with me over a period of time. And we got through lots of different areas. But one of the areas that he really hit on was, he said, you know, I want you to look at, you know, page 28 and 29. And I said, what do you mean? I don't understand. He said, the minute we put our work on a service plan, the alcoholic commences to rely upon our assistance rather than upon God. He was talking about himself. Saying, he was telling me what his relationship with him was going to be like. That he was going to walk me through the steps. He wasn't going to be my banker. He wasn't going to pat me on the butt. He was going to tell me the truth. And he was going to help me find a relationship with God. And then he also told me that I needed to do some other things. He told me that each individual in his personal stories describes in his own language, from his own point of view, the way he established his relationship with God. So he told me I had to listen to you. I had to hear how you established a relationship with God. Because I couldn't do anything else until I had done that. I would not be able to build successful relationships with my employer, successful relationships with people in the program, successful relationships with my family, and successful relationships with men and women unless I had that first. I once was asked, a while ago I was doing that internet dating thing, and I dated this normie, and after a little while she said, you know, I feel like I'm coming second place. And I said, no, it's more like third or fourth. It just came out. I didn't mean to hurt her. But it's the truth. I cannot have that without that. The thing is that I had to start establishing those relationships with God. Because I realized something in personal relationships, that I'd always been looking for the woman of my dreams. And what I needed to do is I needed to change that into me becoming the man of someone else's dreams. If I could change to that man, if I could allow God to change me into that man, I could then maybe possibly become the man of my own dreams. If I could become the man of my own dreams, maybe I could become the man of God's dreams. And if I get to that point, if I can just walk in His will for a little bit, just for a little while, I've got a chance at successful relationships on all levels. I think one of the greatest promises I've ever read in the Big Book comes with a caveat. And it says, see to it that your relationship with Him is right. What does a right relationship with God look like? And that's what I had to learn. I had to learn that how to have a right relationship. I had to learn how to be honest. I had to pray for honesty every single day. I had to ask other people. I had to take examples. We saw how it worked in others. I saw people having successful relationships, and they were based upon things like honesty and trust and kindness and caring. And they did things for each other without having to be asked. And it wasn't based in selfishness and self-centeredness and this horror show that was happening in my own life. And once I began to drop that stuff away, and that's a peeling process that happens through the steps, and it happens to me every single day. It doesn't happen overnight. What I do is I then begin to lose that selfishness. And there's a reason why. Because if I don't, it'll kill me. That's another promise in the Big Book. You know, I always loved those fluffy promises that we'd read at the end of our meetings up in Denver and in Pueblo, you know, and the Ninth Step promises, and they're wonderful. And they've all come true for me. But the fact of the matter is that there's more than that. There are more promises than that in the Big Book. And the thing is that, you know, a friend of mine says, you know, he's from Ireland, and he says, it says you'll comprehend the word serenity. It doesn't say you'll get any, you know. And I always thought, but it does say you'll know peace. And that's the other thing is I had to have a relationship with myself where my own skin fit. Where the man who walked around in his own skin wasn't uncomfortable looking you in the eye. And that was uncovered through the process of the steps. You know, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message. What's the message? The message is I can have a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And the fact is that I've had that. And those relationships have changed. My 81-year-old mother, she called my sister before we left on this trip, and she said, now, John, I understand, is doing a little talk. Is he going to do that? I understand he's talking about the 13th step or something. My mom's been a black belt Al-Anon since, like, 1972. My sister is a proud member of AFG as well. My brother has got 12 years of sobriety. My entire family is in recovery. If this is a family disease, it also, once one person in that family gets sober, the elephant cannot live in the living room anymore. Because the relationships will change, and that's exactly what has happened for me and for countless others, as the Big Book promises. It promised me that. I have an incredible relationship. I've had successful relationships, long-term relationships, based on honesty and kindness and caring, based on me getting out of self, me doing something more. I have relationships with my employer. I have relationships with my patient. In recovery, I managed to go to college through the kindness and caring of other people in relationships. I became a registered nurse. I work in an ER trauma, level 2 trauma in Pueblo, Colorado. Every night, I see alcoholics who are dying, and they're doing it right in front of me. And sometimes the very best thing I can do is work with them for a few minutes and try to make it a little bit better and hope that they can you know, and know that there is a God who can find a relationship for them as well. The thing is that if you're looking for some sort of answer in relationships, if that's what you're looking for, and you expect some speaker to tell you about it, what happens to me is once someone tries to tell me something, the next thing I hear, I don't know about you guys, when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, people would say, you need to, and the next thing I heard was this loud buzzing sound in my head. Rah, you know, sounded like Charlie Brown's teacher. Wow, 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 wow. You know, it's like, I had to establish that stuff on my own through a sponsor, through a personal relationship with God. You know, I still get that in my own relationship with my girlfriend. She's, you know, she sometimes says to me something and I go, wow, and I tune it out because I didn't hear it. She did it to me the other night. I was writing and I was working on a 10 step. Because I need that stuff. I have to do that. I have to do it every single day. My life depends on it. Relationships with God. I'm going to end with this particular relationship with God. In my own work and the things I do, I see things. But I also see miracles that happen every single day. About 2 years ago, I was in La Junta, Colorado. I was working a small, up on a med-surg unit up there. And there was a fellow we had 4-point strapped to the bed who hadn't spoke coherently in 3 days. Pretty much, he'd torn out his catheter. He'd ripped his IVs out of his arm. He'd done everything you can imagine, and we had to protect him for his own safety. He'd do some pretty horrible things. He was in the throes of end-stage alcoholism. His family was in the hall attempting, with a counselor, to figure out how to commit him to life for a mental institution. At that moment, I wasn't even scheduled that day. I came into work because they called me, and I walked in, and I heard an IV beeping, and I thought, oh, I better go fix that. He's probably torn it out again. You know, had one of those moments. And I walked in there, and I began to fix the IV, and he looked at me, and it's the only coherent thing he said for 3 days. He looked at me, and he said, I don't want to die like this. And I said, you don't have to. I've known thousands of men and women who've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, and you can do that too if you find a relationship with your Creator. I don't know how you're going to do that. There's a way out, and I found it, and you can find it too. Now, he didn't say very much after that. I don't know what really happened. I left, and about a year later, I was walking in Pueblo, and this guy came walking up to me, and I didn't know who he was, and he said, do you remember me? And first of all, he walked up to me, and I thought, oh, God, he wants money, and I don't have very much with me right now, and okay. And he said, no, do you remember me? I said, no, I'm sorry, I don't. He said, I was strapped to a bed in La Junta about a year ago, and you came in and you told me I didn't have to live like this, and in 3 days I'm celebrating 1 year of sobriety. The point is that I don't always know what is going to happen when the words come out of my mouth. I don't know what God's got planned. Relationship with God is based on my trust in God, my reliance upon God, because the more I rely upon God, the more reliable God becomes. The more I trust God, the more trustworthy I become. Those things are essential. And if I can't do them, I can't have relationships with you. I can't have relationships with my employer. I can't have relationships with the homeless woman down the street who I watched last night. And, you know, the thing is that I remember that feeling of being invisible. And I walked up to her, and she was eating that pizza out of that box that she'd taken out of that dumpster in the back. And all I could think was, maybe $10 will get her to her bottom. I don't know what's going to get us there. I don't know. But she said to me, she said, when I die, I'll be an angel who's hovering over you, watching over you the rest of your life. And I said, I already have those. You have to have your own. Thank you very much. Yeah.
but you didn't fill it out either. All right, at this time we're going to open up the mic on relationships. Please keep your share to 3 minutes, and I'll take volunteers.
Hi, I'm Jean. I'm an alcoholic. From Madison, Wisconsin. My home group is the Sunriser Group at 7:30 every morning at Fitchburg Serenity Club. And my sobriety date is June 10th, 1997. Thank you, John and Mark. Yes. Wow. I just want to say that my relationships all depend on my relationship with my higher power, which is, for me, God, all my relationships. And when I started depending on God for my needs and not on other people, my relationships improved. And it wasn't through just coming to meetings and, you know, staying on the outskirts. It was from getting a sponsor and looking at my relationship with myself. The reason I was not having good relationships was that I didn't have a very good relationship with myself. And she told me that if I got sober through doing a thorough, searching, fearless moral inventory, but that I had to start praying every day, I had to have a relationship with God because only God would keep me sober. She said that is the first relationship. And let go of all the things of what you think you're going to get in life and just start working on that one. And I would have to say it took me 10 years to get a really healthy relationship with my mother, where I was present. And in the last, that's the thing about relationships. They change. But it's not because the other people change. It's because I change. I had to get out of the self-pity. I had to get out of why I didn't get what I got. Why did I not get more love? Why did I not get more blah, 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 blah. All that shit. If I didn't get sober, I would have still been living in that kind of way. What a shitty way of life that is. My mother gave me my life. And I was holding all these weird, shitty relationships in my head about things I didn't get when I was 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I don't know. She's a wonderful person today. she's not changed. So I just celebrated 13 years. And I just want to say that I don't know what I'd do without God. And what you read here about each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. I need to know how you guys got it. And I found a sponsor that had one. The sponsor I have now has almost 40 years of sobriety, and the reason I picked her 10 years ago was because I could see something in her. She had a trusting relationship with God. She had a spiritual. I want spiritual people in my life. I want people that, because I was already physically sober, emotionally, mentally, but I knew that I needed to work on my relationship with God. So I found someone that had one already, so that I could learn. And now I'm in a relationship of 4 years with the love of my life, and but I love myself. I have to love myself. And every morning I'm on my knees thanking God for helping me stay sober. I'm sober another day. I have been working so hard on my relationship with God because I know that God's will for me is to help others. And I don't know what God's plan is, but if I'm right with God, a lot of miracles happen when I'm right with God. Tons. A new freedom, a new happiness, not my old way of happiness and freedom. And I'm just excited every day to be able to be of service. And my heart overfloweth. So I have to give it away because I'm so happy. And I just thank you so much for sharing. I'll pass.
Hi, my name is Megan, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. Hi. Thanks for your service this morning. My sobriety date is March 8th of this year, and my home group is Sober Sisters. And I realize that relationship with self, I see self in others, and I know that to love another human being and to love myself at the same time is really difficult. I know God puts people into my life to show me about myself and what I do and don't see in myself. And I'm grateful to be sober today. Thank you.
Morning. My name's Norman. Sobriety day is 1977, August the 5th. All in a row, if that's important. We have a solution to relationships, and it's in our preamble. We are a group of men and women who share our experience, strength, and hope with each other so that we may help get sober and help others do that also. That's our purpose of being here. And where does that come from? Our home group. Our common welfare is the unity of the Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where we find a loving God, and that's where we find somebody we can trust. I've been a long while in a lot of meetings, and I don't trust nobody. Is a common thought when we come in that program, Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you have go get a home group, they've been elected by the people you go to meeting with, and they're there for a year with the rotation of what the AA's been assigned with. That's how we get sober, through a group where a loving God is and he's not hid. They're alive, working, and putting forth the efforts that you read at every meeting. This is a New Hope group. This is what we do. That's what we believe. That's what we stand for. Where you sign slips or whatever, don't make a difference. Where you don't let court-appointed people there, don't make a difference. It's where somebody is there with a home group that's alive and well, and the group is self-supporting. Thank you.
My name is Jamie Jones. I'm an alcoholic. This is my very first convention. I come from a small town in northeast Texas called Texarkana, Texas. Most of my life in sobriety, I've been fueled and inspired by the people that tell their stories at conventions and tapes, and I really do appreciate that. It's an honor to hear y'all talk. I'd like to share just a small part of my story. Over the last 10 years, I've been sober since February the 18th of the year 2000. I've always put everything I've ever had in Alcoholics Anonymous. And everybody's always said, no matter what you put in, you'll always get back. And in my life, that's true today. I had about 9 years sober. It was January the 24th of last year. Me and my wife and my 16-year-old daughter and my 7-year-old son just moved into a new house. And my wife called me at work. It was right after Christmas. And she said the house was on fire. And on my way home, I'm thinking it's a small fire. It's no big deal. And by the time I get there, there's like 6 fire trucks, and they're just spraying the house with water from every direction. My neighbors are on top of the roof, and my wife's face first in the grass and the dirt of our next-door neighbor's yard, screaming, crying with my mother-in-law next to her. And I look up at the house, and I remember thinking, how is this part of God's will? I'm thinking, 9 years sober. The only thing I've ever done is drag these damn drunks from the Randy Sam's homeless shelter and the Salvation Army over to my house. I said, it was an electrical fire. And I knew, me and my wife had already talked about it. One day, my daughter would definitely burn her house down by leaving her flat iron plugged in, or one of these drunks would fall asleep with a cigarette on the stomach. And then I called my sponsor and I told him what was happening. And he called the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, they started showing up right about the time that I started freaking out. they had the horrible sense of humor alcoholics do. One of the guys that I'd helped get sober, he had bounced out of the program two years in and out. Him and my wife were singing "The Roof Is on Fire, We Don't Need No Water," and you know the rest of the song. They were coming up saying, "Hey, is this a bad time?" And you know, a house burning down is a really bad, it's a really bad incident. It was a really bad deal, especially, you know, we didn't have any insurance, none. And I wondered, what were we going to do? As I opened the garage up to my house, the toys that my kids got for Christmas and my wife's clothes were floating down into the gutters of the streets. And the fire guys were coming by. You know, the guys say, "Hey, did you have insurance?" You know, one after the other. I'm like, dang, these people are just, I swear, I was like, the next one that comes up, I'm just going to punch him right in his mouth. And then this guy walks up to me, and I'm thinking, oh, here he is. Here's another one. It's time, you know. But I didn't think I could take him, so I listened to what he had to say. And he said, I'd never met him before in my life. And he said that, "Hey, is this your house?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, Well, I have another house you might want to move into. Come check it out." And he gave me his card. And the house was three times the size of the house that we lived in that was burning. And it had a big jacuzzi tub and a big man cave with a 10-foot TV and surround sound and a chimney and two garages, two shops. I mean, it was huge. It was really a huge house compared to the one we lived in. And it was 4 days after the house burned down that I'd had new flat-screen TVs and that 10-foot TV and all the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. By 2 o'clock, the house started burning, and by 10 o'clock, I had about $10,000 from AA members. And it's a real small town. And these people, sometimes I see them, and I think, they don't even put dollars in baskets. They're not going to help me out, you know. But I knew there were some wealthy guys in Texarkana that was an Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew they were going to come to my aid. They were probably going to measure my arms and see where my shirts needed to be cut off, and I was going to get custom-built pants and stuff. Those guys never came over. The guys that came and gave me $100 bills were guys that paid child support and probation, and the guys that were homeless that I drug off the streets in Alcoholics Anonymous in Texarkana. Unemployed people came over to my house and helped set everything up and build stuff. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fantastic place for anybody, especially a person with 9 years sober, thinking that he knows everything there is to know about God and relationships. And that really did define the human race for me. I had lost a little faith. I work at a pawn shop. And they say that Alcoholics Anonymous makes it better whatever you are out of you. So, you know, liar, cheat, and thief, at least it pays today. You know? Thank y'all for listening to me. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Denise, and I am an alcoholic. And my home group is the Lambda Group in Albany, New York. And my sobriety date is 12/12/1990. Stop for a minute. I just want to share a little bit about these built-in forgetters we have. I want to thank you guys so much for sharing. I got so much out of your share. You know, I moved to Albany 12 years ago from New York City. And when I left there, I left my sponsor, my support group, my therapist, doctors, everyone there. And when I got to Albany, you know, thank God, you know, where I grew up in sobriety, I got sober feet. So I knew I had to get another sponsor. So I went around. I had the hardest time trying to find a sponsor. For some reason, they do things different up there. And and I started to pray. I started to pray. And God put a wonderful woman in my life that became my sponsor for the 12 years that I've been in Albany. And she died suddenly a month ago. And I'm dreading to go through that process again. But I just want to thank you, Mark, for reminding me that all I have to do is pray. And just like God put her in my life, God will find someone else to put in my life. And, you know, and with 19 and a half years, it's like I still need a sponsor. I still need guidance. There's still things that I need to know. You know, I need to learn. I'm still teachable, you know. And this is a fellowship of men and women, you know. I don't care if it's a man or woman or, well, I do care if it's a horse or a dog, but it's like, but I do, you know, I don't care if it's a man or a woman. And again, I want to thank you for reminding me that all I have to do is pray, and I know that God is going to put somebody in my life. I had my mindset that I was going to come here, I was going to find somebody here. I says, we're coming up on almost 20 years of sobriety. I can have a sponsor in Texas. You know, I can have a sponsor in Minnesota or somewhere, you know, with all the internet and all that stuff going on now. And I just want to say this is like, you know, where I grew up in sobriety is like this thing about temporary sponsorship. You know, my sponsor told me that if you want temporary recovery, then you get a temporary sponsor. You know, so I want a real sponsor. Thank you.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Rich.
Hey, Rich.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to anyone who's new. Just keep coming back. And thanks, guys. Thanks for sharing your experience, strength, and hope. My sobriety date is April 19th, 1987. My home group is now in Alexandria, Virginia. It's a men's meeting on Saturday mornings at 8:30 at the Salvation Army. We call ourselves the Slow Learners. And I got sober in Tucson, Arizona. I was there for 8.5 years and then moved to Seattle and now out in Washington, D.C. On this topic, it always brings to mind what my first wife said to me as we were going through our divorce was, I wish I were your second wife. You know, I don't think my second wife likes being my second wife. You know, because being an alcoholic in recovery, even with years in doing this, what I've come to understand for myself is that the longer I stay sober, the deeper my character defects are. And again, it goes back to the first round of 6 and 7 after doing 4 and 5 in uncovering those defects of characters and which ones are very shallow, and as you peel the layers of the onion, they just shed away through the process. But the longer we stay sober, those defects of character that are really rooted down deep, that have defined us for so long, continue to get in the way of our relationships. You know, for me, the thing that changed, that has changed all this is I now have, you know, at 50 years old, a 5-year-old daughter. You know, and I'm one of those that didn't want to have kids, you know. Because I was going to have a son, and that son of a bitch was going to be just like me. You know, I didn't want that payback. Instead, I got a little girl who's just like me. You know? And the danger of this, you know, I mean, I learn it when I hear the words coming out of the car seat behind me that are being repeated, you know, at the drivers in Washington, D.C. But, And there's a knowing that I have to change, because what I don't want is I don't want my daughter to feel like she needs someone like me, like the drunk and the junkie that I used to be, that I can still be at times, that's attractive, that's going to shape who she's going to look for in a man. You know, that I instead have to do what's already been talked about is, you know, is become the man of her dreams. You know, and start living a life that's based on the spiritual principles that have been talked about this morning. You know, that she truly has become my 6 and 7. You know, and I just really look forward. If you're new in sobriety, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. This is, you know, I was around through Seattle, through San Diego, through Minneapolis. This is a great way of life. And you just have no idea what's in front of you. You just have none. All of it. You know, the good and the bad. It's great to be here. Thanks, guys.
Good morning, everyone. John Petz, alcoholic. It's an honor and a privilege to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Since we're in Texas, I'm going to do as they do in Texas. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since January 31st of 1985 by the grace of God in the program Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is the absolute truth. You know, somebody like me doesn't get from there to here without a lot of grace of God. I can tell you that right now. Because, you know, one of the relationships that I did not have when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous was any kind of relationship with God. And, you know, I fought that relationship for a long time because, like it talks about in the book, you know, it was really easy for me to give my alcoholism to God. But all that other stuff, you know, that I wanted to manage and control because I knew what was best for me, I had a hard time giving that up. And I had a hard time giving that to God. You know, and there was a lot of fear, and there was a lot of resentment about that relation, about that, and doing that. You know, and just like it says in the book, you know, pain is the touchstone of spiritual growth. I had to get into a lot of pain before I could finally let go completely, you know, and give up all my old ideas. You know, and it doesn't matter what sort of situation I'm in, what kind of relationship I'm in. I guess that's the topic. It's kind of like the third rail, you know, in a streetcar. If you touch that third rail of relationships, you might, that might hurt. But, you know, all my old ideas affect my relationships. And the hardest thing that has occurred for me is to let you be you. And just take you as you are. You know, I was downstairs this morning and saw a gentleman from San Diego, actually from Oceanside, take 55 years. And I was talking with my new bride of 6 months. And thank you, love. Afterwards, and this man is just he's a gentleman and he's a gentle man. And he would never have an unkind word to say about anybody. I can't say the same about me, because I'm just as likely to take your inventory as I am to take my own. That's just the way it is. But, you know, the book also talks about the fact that one of our primary problems is that we find it difficult or almost impossible to develop a true partnership with another human being. And for me, what that has meant is that I've got to have my own relationship with God. I've got to be complete and I've got to be at whole in that relationship before I can have any hope of being of any use to anybody else. You know, when I say my prayers in the morning, I ask God to direct my thoughts and actions so that I can be of maximum service to Him and the people around me. And then I get up and I walk out the door and I fail miserably. I fail miserably. And that's okay. Because then when I see you fail miserably, I have to remember, they're human too. They have clay feet, just like I have clay feet. So it's great to be here at the International. It's great to be in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, as I said. And I want to thank John for asking me to talk.
All right, let's close this little puppy here and... I want to thank Mark and John. Give us a hand. Fantastic. Yeah, fantastic job. And let's do our little circle and close the usual manner. Thank you all for being here.